Monkey Lab. This story starts where probably all stories start regarding monkey business, and that is in freshman year in college. Perhaps it starts earlier involving my preoccupation with film. However, that seems to get transcendental. So, for our purposes, let me set the stage. Back at good old Stony Brook University. As a freshman, I was a double major in computer science and mathematics and double minoring in music and art. Pretty ironic considering my minors would be a major part of my life and the majors are a minor part of the story. Stony Brook was pretty much a gray campus, which was in part designed by the Army Corps of Engineers. Not so surprising if you went to school there. And its buildings and subsequent hallways seemed to create a giant labyrinth that was commonly thought to be a giant psych experiment run by the psychology department or a weird government collaborative. Stony Brook had ties with Brookhaven Labs and in some other funky scientific experiments. But I get ahead of myself. So I'm in CSE 103, I think. CSE standing for Computer Science Engineering. And it is a class of over 1,000 students, most of which are struggling to be engineers to make a lot of cash. Not me. I was a hacker for about 10 years by then, and I was in college to legitimize myself. The department said it wasn't a weed-out course. But with 1,000 students, it was hard not to call it that with only 80 computers at our disposal to finish our projects. Back then, computers were not in every household. Plus, we were running programs that most machines couldn't understand anyway. Most of my programming time consisted of me sitting in a lab waiting for a computer to free up. For hours or days, me and many others would wait for a terminal to be free. I would stare at the others struggling to compile their programs and watch the agony as the green diode screens would spit garbage out at them. There was the roar of the incessant printer to document trials and error. I remember people thought computers would put paper manufacturers out of business. I sat and watched as one lab decimate a small forest. One Saturday, sitting with my friends, Chris, and another guy named Rob, we would muse about life, the universe, and everything, until one day, in the background, we heard people playing racquetball. This pissed us off to no end. Trapped in this dungeon, waiting to put in our hacked code, we were forced to hear the screeches of sneakers and others who were obviously enjoying themselves, trying to release their stress. But for us, pure torture. What are you guys talking about? One of the TAs stopped our rant in our tracks. Racquetball? There aren't any racquetball courts in here. Comp Sci shares the same building with the graduate biosciences. What you're hearing is the monkey lab during feeding time. Instantaneously, the sounds morphed. Our imaginations flared. We knew we had to see the monkeys. You'll never get into the lab. It is locked and sealed. Concentrate on getting your code in. The TA left, but it was too late. We knew what we had to do, and that was to get into the monkey lab. The TA was right. After weeks of trying, we found out that the biolabs were sealed behind at least 2 locked doors, and there were no windows to the labs themselves. Day and night, we explored the building and its many hallways. We even found a quicker way into the building through the loading docks. It had a great view of one of the lab's entrances right in front of a bunch of empty silver cabinets with sliding trays, a never-ending source of fun at 3 a.m. in the morning. After a while, we gave up our folly to concentrate on more productive goals, until Chris one day rekindled our quest. We can use the tunnel! Rob and I looked back at Chris incredulously. This is where he starts to explain how he found an underground network of tunnels beneath Stony Brook campus. That's right, I know. An underground network of tunnels connecting buildings throughout the university. An underground labyrinth. Pretty ridiculous, huh? It seems like when they designed the set of state universities in New York, a network of underground tunnels was built so students could travel from building to building in times of emergency. I don't know what emergency could happen on Long Island except for a hurricane or a nuclear power reactor meltdown at the Shoreham Wading River Power Authority. A nuclear power plant on an island is not a brilliant idea, but that's a whole nother story. Or maybe perhaps an accident at Brookhaven Labs. Regardless, I don't think anybody would be going to class in these sort of emergencies. However, I heard that SUNY Buffalo does actually use these tunnels when it is ridiculously cold with 6 feet of snow. Someone even told me that they sell coffee down there, but I'm not sure I believe that. Meanwhile, I can vouch that even though primarily unused, there is a tunnel network under Stony Brook. Generally, all these entrances to the tunnels are locked. However, the entrance in the psych building was open. And while it was an entrance across campus, we were confident we would be able to navigate and enter the monkey lab from below. So the next night, we got ready to descend. We brought flashlights and started the journey. We soon discovered that we were going to need a compass and other tools. But in the coming weeks, the three of us charted the various passages leading to different buildings all over the campus. Some doors were locked, both from the inside and the outside. Some were barred, or the doors were jammed. Others were open and led to a treasure of adventure with each discovery. We got into the library, and we got into the bookstore. Several dorms where their old bars existed when it was still a wet campus. We even got into campus security, all of which were lots of fun, but they could not deter us from our goal, the monkey lab. One day we traveled down a long passageway. Lights in the tunnels were always intermittent, but this particular tunnel seemed darker. The first odd thing was the car, a burnt out car. Chris immediately began to jump out and slam the door as best as he could. Me and Rob just stared at it. He was the first to comment on how could a car get down into the tunnels in the first place. I wondered why a burnt-out car would be down here. No one in their right mind would bring it down here in that condition. And who would burn a car in a confined space? It just seemed odd. Chris was undaunted. And after getting bored of using the car as a jungle gym, we continued on. Then we saw the scroll on the wall. Beware of the Morlocks. A chill went down my spine. Of course, this must have been some graffiti of an overzealous geek. But still, what are Morlocks? I started to explain about the time machine and the relationship the underground dwelling of the Morlocks had to the unsuspecting people above. Soylent Green is people! No. Wrong movie. Another story. No. Chris was still unimpressed, and he plunged into the ever-growing darkness. Rob was a little bit more cautious. It was slow going because of the various detritus which was littering the ground. I think we're almost there, he called back from the dark. And then we turned the corner and saw the pit. This is where things really started to get a little weird. On our side of the pit, there was garbage on the ground, these huge drums for large telephone cable, and lots of refuge, and dark. The other side was pristine, a gray hallway illuminated by a red light, with a spiral staircase leading to the surface. And then there was the pit. It wasn't a break in the concrete. It wasn't an unfinished part of the tunnel. It was a constructed pit that spanned the entire width from wall to wall and separated us evenly from the other side by about 50 feet. Now, out of the pit stood many wood poles that appeared to be like telephone poles. They stood like toothpicks in a glass jar and created a couple of leaping paths to the other side across the pit. The thing is, why would someone throw huge poles into a pit? Why would the pit be there in the first place? And lastly, how deep was the pit? Well, naturally being curious, we took our flashlights to see how far the bottom was. Our flashlights were not strong enough to illuminate this fact. I looked at Rob. He was not convinced of the safety of trying to traverse this obstacle. Chris theorized it couldn't be that deep. I decided to drop a rock. It fell. But there was no thud. None. Now we're a little freaked out. We threw another. Same result. Chris theorized that there must be sand, and that is why the poles stand up in the pit, and that's why there wasn't any thud of any kind. The rock was hitting the bottom, but we just couldn't hear it. I wasn't so convinced, but Chris had already started traversing the pit, using the poles much like stepping stones across a quickly moving river. To my surprise, all the poles were stable, and I followed in his footsteps. Rob was a bit more cautious and took his time. On the other side, we surveyed the terrain and stared at the spiral staircase that went up. We all looked at each other. "So now what?" I sighed and slowly began the ascent of the circling and twisting stairway, step by step until I reached the top. There, at the top, was a simple gray door with a bar across it to open it into the supposed monkey lab. The time was now, and I leaned in to press the bar and open the door. Whoop, 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 whoop. All hell breaks loose. We stared at each other, frozen like deer in headlights. "Run!" We tear off down the stairs, leap like gazelles across the pit, and tear off into the darkness until we reach the broken entrance, out of breath, panting. The next day, we'd learn about an alarm that went off in the bio building that the fire department responded to. It was talk about going back, but I was already paranoid about my fingerprints, and I was positive the way we'd be blocked or guarded the second time. Weeks later, late one night, leaving the building through the loading dock, we noticed someone had left the door open to the monkey lab. We were all shocked, and Chris is about to lead the charge. "Wait," I said. All this time going through the loading dock entrance, it suddenly dawned on me what these silver cabinets with the trays inside were. They were the cabinets I've seen in many movies and TV shows that held bodies in a morgue. When I explained this to my two cohorts, they looked at me and Chris said, "No, they're too short. They're hardly even 5 feet length. Nobody could fit in that." And they looked at him. I said, "Nobody but a monkey." We were quiet for some time and looked back at the door to the lab. Chris finally hesitated, and someone came through, looked at the three of us. I don't know what we would have seen if we had gone through those doors, if we would have gotten caught, if we would have actually found the monkey lab. I don't know if we would have seen a bunch of happy-go-lucky monkeys or tortured little creatures or disease-ridden suffering animals from the various maniacal experiments that were going on at Stony Brook. Of course, I know when we had gotten there, we probably would have tried to touch them, pet them. And it all seems silly, really. But the journey, the thought of the journey even, still thrills me to no end. The quest to see something that our imaginations conjured up, and this exhilaration that only the young can truly appreciate, even towards oh-so-common goal. The exhilaration, the completion of yet a common goal that we all will meet at some end.